Greetings, I'm James Gillen, your host tonight, and we've got another great show. Before I bring Thomas on the show, I want to talk about just a few things that are going on right now so you kind of have a little heads up. We are just getting hit with some piggyback M-class flares, one after another, and we all know what that means. It's going to be affecting the bioelectric fields around the body and creating all kinds of emotional outbursts. Some people get real tired. All kinds of things to be going on. Equipment's going to be failing. A couple days ago, the cashiers at the store couldn't actually use any of the ATM cards, or you know, it's just a real mess. But every place we went to buy some goods or whatever on our, you know, annual shopping spree, you might say, it going into town, just nothing worked. So that was kind of interesting watching that happen. So I think that's a direct result of these M-class flares coming in. And today was just phenomenal. Just being outdoors at all, everybody got sunburned and we're all kind of, a little lethargic and feeling a little down, a little bit of headaches and just trying to adjust the new energy. So I'd be a heads up. I mean, there's going to be a lot of erratic weather, some really severe weather following these CMEs, and probably an increase in earthquake and volcanic activity coming up. So pay attention to your neighborhood. A lot of things going on. That being said, I want to bring Thomas on the show. Our guest is Thomas P. Fusco. He's an independent researcher who's devoted nearly three decades investigating the relationship between mind, physics, spirituality, parapsychology, scientific anomalies, and paranormal phenomena, with the goal of uncovering the unifying cosmological framework that has eluded mankind for generations. He's been invited to speak as a guest on over 100 national and international radio programs, including Coast to Coast AM. So without any further ado, I want to bring Thomas on the show. Thomas, are you with us?
Oh, yes, I am, James.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we all have, it seems like we have a lot of similar interests here, and there's so many different ones. I'd love to find out, you know, just basically what brought you into this field, or what inspired you to start investigating into this field?
Well, I was always, I was one of those kids that always needed to know why behind everything.
Uh-huh.
And this insatiable curiosity. So I studied science. That was my chosen field because this gave me answers to questions. Apparently very solid answers that I thought at the time. But in my teens and early 20s, I had several experiences that caused me to call into question the model of the universe that I was taught in physics, that, you know, these types of events, these types of observations were not described or accounted for in that model. So for me, the compelling question then became, what kind of a universe could allow these things to occur? How could the universe be put together to enable these kinds of events to take place? And so that actually began my journey. And then in my late 20s, I applied myself very diligently and seriously to the task. And, of course, the results are in the book that I published.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the name of your book? So, if the guests want to actually connect in with that, and you know, get the book, and basically, how can they get it?
The book is called "Behind the Cosmic Veil: A New Vision of Reality, Merging Science, the Spiritual, and the Supernatural." And you can find out about the book, read a sample chapter, the table of contents, related articles. And everything else about the book, including the links to where you can get it. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and through our own publisher site. And that's all at www.cosmicveil, spelled V-E-I-L, cosmicveil.com.
Great. Yeah, I want to get that out of the way. We'll bring that up again at the end of the hour and make sure people have access to that book. I'm really fascinated by some of the things you're talking about, how you actually gleaned some of your wisdom through the ancient biblical texts. I'd love to go into that if you would.
Sure. For me, one of the paradigms that I looked at was that everything physical must conform to a given set of laws and principles. We know this about the universe at large. We're still in the process of discovering different aspects of those laws and principles. But we've learned enough now. Our powers of observation and our instrumentation has taken us far enough to realize that the laws of the universe apply throughout the cosmos, that what applies here applies everywhere else that we could find in the universe. And so for me, the human brain, of course, is a physical object, and it is a subset of the greater universal system, and therefore must be built along the same laws and principles. Further, thinking along these lines further, James, what I surmised, what I came to the conclusion of, is that information in the form, let's say, of long traditional standing religious principles, that's a form of information. If the human brain is something like a creative computer, so to speak, and you program that computer with accurate information, that means information that is consistent with the way that the universe is actually put together, the laws and the principles which govern that universe. If the information you program into that brain is consistent with those laws and principles, we should see an effect that comes out of the human brain that interacts with its environment and exercises a greater degree of control and power over that environment, because the creative mind is acting upon information that accurately reflects the way that the universe is put together. Therefore, it should give us greater power over that universe. And in thinking about, you know, the way the changes of people's lives from, embracing these religious principles, the kinds of developments that we've even made in science, because we have to keep in mind that some of the greatest thinkers that we've had in Western science began with part of their premise that the universe was built according to a divine order. Isaac Newton, James Clerk Maxwell, Gregor Mendel, on and on, even Galileo, all believed in this divine order as reflected, let's say, in the Bible. And obviously the fruits of their labors are apparent. So for me, I felt that the Bible was a valid place to look for this kind of programming, this kind of information that would reflect in some way the way that the universe is actually structured.
Mm-hmm. Now, in reading the Bible, it seems like if we go at it, you know, from a place of ignorance or an unknowing place and read it, we will never understand it. But if we really know what happened in the past, the real history, and have a good grasp of physics, we can see that a lot of the parables and a lot of the stories they're talking about are actually have this ancient wisdom within them, and not be led down that path of just, you know, agreeing to whatever's said, you know, up at the pulpit. And like you were saying, you probably gotten into a lot of trouble, you know, asking those hard questions either in school or, you know, from the ministers or the clergy, you might say.
Yes. I mean, even in my own work, there's a small handful of people who outright reject my work because it has any kind of spiritual or religious elements within its reckoning. a few of those even vehemently opposing them. But what I tried to do was to take a look, first of all, to what the text actually says, to the best that we can determine, without any kind of particular denominational preconceptions or traditional doctrines that a certain denomination might have, to just take a look at what the Bible says in its wording, and then see what kind of relationships that could be drawn to standard physics, to our known sciences, with those passages that specifically relate to the way that the physical universe might be constructed, characteristics and aspects that relate directly to the physical, not necessarily to the spiritual. And so that's where I began to get some very important correlations.
Now, has your research brought you to the understanding that there is some kind of a vibrational continuum or a process where things actually go from maybe consciousness to light to energy to mass?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a fundamental question that is still facing physics today. And unfortunately, neither quantum physics nor Einstein's relativity really provides an answer for it. And what that question is how did the universe become as orderly as it is? The universe has an extreme degree of high order. And according to our known scientific principles, we would call that in physics a highly improbable state. And to give you an example, and, you know, this is one of the subjects that physicists don't normally like to discuss too openly to the layperson, to the public, because it reflects how little they really know, or how little we really know. An example I use, James, is to take a box. Let's say we have a transparent box out of glass, and it's completely sealed. Nothing can get inside and out. And what's in the box is filled with common air, and we have it on our table. It's at standard temperature and pressure, just a volume of normal air surrounded by this sealed box. We can see inside of it. Now, that air comprises many different gases. We have oxygen, nitrogen, helium, argon, many different types of gases in it. And they're in a gaseous state. That's the third state of matter, which is highly active. And so all these particles are bouncing around in this box, and they're consistently making the air a homogeneous mixture, where there is no distinct structure in it. Any kind of a structure that might begin to arise, like a couple of oxygen molecules or atoms, for example, may try to collect together out of random chance. The interaction of all these excited particles would completely destroy that structure. So in physics, we would call this a highly disordered state. But we would also call it the most probable state of matter, because this would be what would normally happen, let's say, like in the cosmic soupy cloud of the Big Bang. Now, let's imagine that all the oxygen atoms inside that air suddenly collect. They come out of the other part of the gases, separate themselves, and collect into one corner of the box. Now we have order and structure, because that structure is defined by the separation between that pocket of oxygen and the rest of the gases. excuse me. This is considered a state of high order. It's also considered the most improbable state of the mass inside the box. There should be no reason why this happens. But that's exactly what happened in the early universe. And this is something that modern physics is still struggling with. How did order arise out of chaos? For another example, when we hear about quantum physics and we talk about the randomness and the uncertainty and unpredictability and the lack of that definitiveness on the subatomic level, and yet when it rises up and assembles itself into the macro universe, it's an incredibly ordered universe. We have no idea how this extreme predictability arises out of this uncertain soup in this subatomic level. So the question then becomes, where did this universal order come from? Did the universe create it itself, as the materialists say, that everything in the universe is self-determining, or in other words, every physical effect in the universe has a physical cause, which is also local to the effect in the same physical universe? Or did that order arise from a higher place, from a place above the physical universe, and that order unfolded into the order that we see in the physical? And I argue, based on the latest failures of physics to find physical causes for all the effects that we can now observe, that I argue that this is evidence that there is an order to the universe that mm-hmm. is above what exists in the physical.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that I just got back from a little fishing trip, and and I was sitting there out in the middle of nature in just this beautiful, pristine environment, looking at down in the water, and I was just contemplating that on how, this whole picture was put together, with the beautiful trees, the other plant life there along the bank, the fish, the bugs, the just the water itself, and everything, how this all came together in just a beautiful picture of creation. And the more I contemplated it, I just could not accept the fact that this was just came out of chaos, that there wasn't some divine intelligence, wherever that intelligence resides, I can't say, but on some level, there was some major work done, might say, or some genetic tinkering or something done, to bring this all about. I just don't see how it could have happened randomly.
Well, certainly, when we contemplate such things and contemplate them openly and honestly, we can get that impression. We get a sense of this. Einstein had a sense of it. He spoke of, anyone who really, with an open heart and mind, takes a look at the way the universe is through science, he said that he couldn't understand how you could fail to see this spirit that imposed this order on this universe that was so far more complex than anything that we could comprehend with our human minds. And in another place, he also criticized what he called the radical religious. And by that, he didn't mean the deeply spiritual. That's something very different than being radically religious, as we all know. And the radical atheists, he said both of these positions come from the same place inside of a person. And he called such people creatures who could not hear the music of the spheres. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, today in physics, we're dominated by a philosophy which really is atheistic, that beneath it is a fundamental belief that everything is materialistic, everything is mm-hmm. physical. There are no extra physical causes. And so when we can't find a physical cause to an effect, we conjure one up. We just make it up and mm-hmm. say, since everything must be physical, then this imaginary material must exist. And things like that are dark matter, dark energy, supersymmetry. This is where these concepts grow from a strict adherence to a completely materialistic picture of the universe. But that picture can't tell us where order came from. And
I agree.
The kind of order that you're talking about, yeah, observing going out fishing. We have no expression in modern physics that even gives us a clue to what physical cause might have given rise to such an order.
Yeah. I tell you, I had a crazy trip. I caught some beautiful trout and, you know, kept them alive and brought them home to my pond. But one of my best catches was I was looking down at the bottom of the lake, this crystal clear lake, and there was a Bud Light down there on the bottom of the lake. And
oh, my.
I snagged it with a hook and brought it up, and it was totally unopened. And a nice chilled Bud Light. So I'm going to make a little fishing plaque and hang that up on it or something. But that's kind of off subject. But I just think about that. Okay, what are the odds of being out in this lake in a canoe and looking down and seeing an unopened Bud Light and then actually hooking the cap, you know?
Oh, my, yes.
You know, that was pretty funny to me anyway. But, I pulled that Bud up and I said, yes, there is a God, you know. But even though I don't drink very often, but it was quite a gift. But anyway, getting back on the subject, I always wonder, you know, that most physicists, you know, they all agree that we have at least 11 more dimensions out there. And, you know, if they're in agreement of that, they also say that we can only, you know, actually measure less than 1% of the universe we live in. And, you know, in the same quote, they want you to prove non-physical events, or you have to put your whole reality into their 1% or it's not valid.
Well, I would, yes, it's probably more accurate to say that they believe that whatever model that you come up with, whatever description of any kind of process or causality mm-hmm. has to fit within the philosophy that produced the 1%. Which is probably a more accurate way to put it. Not everyone in the physics community is, subscribes to string theory, mm-hmm. which is one of the theories that, you know, talks about these extra dimensions. There are certain problems with string theory. We don't have an expression yet as to how these dimensions fold in to the four dimensions of space-time that we can observe, and that is a fundamental nature of the field of space which all of physical matter occupies. But one thing about these kinds of theories, which is very interesting, and this will get very very close to the heart of my theory and what I talk about, is that it depends upon a physical expression for gravity. Now, people wouldn't think of gravity normally in association with supernatural phenomenon and this type of thing. But the problem with gravity is that we really haven't determined yet, in a material sense, what gravity is. When you were taught about gravity in school, they kind of misled you a little bit. You really weren't being taught about gravity. You were being taught about gravitational effect. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we know quite a bit about gravitational effect. But the substance of gravity itself, based on a materialistic paradigm, requires the existence of a hypothetical particle called a graviton, which mm-hmm. is a particle of gravity. All forces are supposed to be conveyed as particles that propagate as waves. As in electromagnetism, we have electrons that propagate as electromagnetic fields. But decades of research has never revealed the existence of a graviton. And it's only the only reason why we would believe it exists is because everything in the physical universe has to have a physical cause. Now, my model doesn't require a graviton for an expression of gravity. And so one of the positions I take is that after decades of looking for it, we need to consider the idea that the graviton does not exist. And if the graviton doesn't exist, and this is what most people are not aware of, James, all those weird theories to try to plunge and shoehorn every observation into a physical explanation, like string theory, M theory, supersymmetry, without the graviton, they all collapse. They just vaporize. So that's very interesting. So to me, the understanding gravity is really the key to unlocking the main mechanism behind the formation of an orderly universe.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I know, I think it was Schauberger's work. He was talking about how the, you know, Newton figured out the law of gravity, and when the apple dropped down and hit him on the head. But I always wonder, you know, he said the one thing he didn't talk about is how the apple got up there in the first place. And that's another a whole science in itself.
Yes, it is. And, you know, Newton was never able to really give us a good expression of gravity. He never really figured out what it was. Einstein is actually the closest that came to revealing to us the nature of gravity. And, of course, this grew out of Einstein's vision of the universe as a single field, which he ultimately tried to prove mathematically in his unified field theory. He failed to prove it mathematically, surprisingly enough, because he could not figure out how to express gravity mathematically through the three spatial and one temporal dimensions. And so he, too, stumbled on gravity, but he understood it was a function of the bending of space. And this bending of space and the associated gravitational effect is what is a fundamental key to my particular work.
Mm-hmm. The you know, going back to the Big Bang, I've always had a theory that it's the Big Bang is half the equation, because you know you have this explosion and then everything radiates out from this Big Bang. But you know, the other half of the equation is you have to have, if you have expansion, you have to have contraction. And so to have a balanced theory, you know, where is the contraction side of the thing that actually gave birth to the expansion or the Big Bang itself?
I'm not 100% clear on where we would have a contraction that would be, you know, coexistent with this expansion. You know, if we were blowing up a balloon, for example, mm-hmm. and all that we were considering as what is reality, as what is the universe, would be the surface of that balloon and its content. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be considering anything outside of it. And so in that particular parameter, all we would have is expansion. We wouldn't mm-hmm. really have a contraction. You know, maybe you're thinking of, you know, something in a way that maybe isn't being expressed in a way that I can understand it.
Yeah. Well, basically what my... my theory, you might say, and other people have the same theory, is that there's, you know, everything is balanced, you know, in the universe. There's yin, yang, positive, negative, male, female, whatever. And so, you know, if this balloon is being blown up, like who's blowing up the balloon? And, you know, there has to be, you know, the like the lungs would have to contract on the other side to blow the balloon up, you know, to make the balloon expand.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, so the big question is, okay, who's blowing up the balloon?
There you go. Well, one of the what I found is that the breakthroughs that I made in my work were the result of new paradigms of mm-hmm. looking at things in a different way than they were looked at before. And so, you know, what we observe in the universe and its universal expansion is not, we don't see any evidence for a counterbalancing contraction. But if we consider what is outside of the physical universe, mm-hmm. by its very definition, it would not be physical. And therefore, we wouldn't have a physical cause to a physical effect, because
exactly.
then we would be back to materialism.
Yeah, exactly. My thing is that I think the contraction actually comes from a higher dimension, a non-physical cause, where the you know, whatever intelligence on that other side or whatever that higher dimension is actually collapsing time and actually creating the contraction for the Big Bang, and that whole Big Bang was done by an intelligence that set that whole thing in motion, knowing the beginning and the end of it.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting to think that, you know, on a more base level, what I think is on the Earth, you look at all the genetics here on the Earth, and just all the different plant forms and varieties of flowers and animals and everything else, and it looks like some higher intelligence did a lot of tinkering here. I just don't see how that all just came about through some kind of random mutation.
Well, again, if you look at it from a materialistic paradigm, that every physical effect contained within the dimensional universe has to have a physical cause, mm-hmm. also contained within that same universe, then you just say, out of that philosophical position, that, well, this must have been so. We can't explain it yet, but this order must have arisen out of uncertainty, out of quantum uncertainty. Although we really can't explain how, we have almost a religious faith based mm-hmm. on our religious doctrine that it must be so. But we can't explain it scientifically.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I got in a lot of trouble in chemistry class, and actually one of the professors invited me not to come to class anymore because
oh my
yeah because I kept asking him those questions, you know, okay, where, you know, I understand the periodic table, you know, I understand the, you know what's going on here and everything else, you know, but I kept going down to, you know, he was into electrons and neutrons and protons and things like that. I said, but, you know, where did those come from? You know, and the best he could come up with was quarks, you know, and then I'd say, but, you know, I just feel there's something behind the door here that you're not telling me. And you know, he got pretty upset with me a few times and he actually eventually invited me not to come back to class.
I can understand. You're making his job hard.
Yeah.
That was outside of his, you know, his curriculum. But, you know, the point that you're bringing up, James, is very valid. You know, even if we go down to the minutest of particles that we know comprise the larger particles that we see and ultimately, you know, collaborate to produce our macro universe at large. Mm-hmm. We have no explanation as to how an orderly particle, because it has to have a distinct order Otherwise, it's not anything. A thing must have a distinct order that classifies it and defines it and recognizes it as something unique, distinct, observable, measurable. It has to have an order. We don't know where that order comes from. One of the attempts to at least solve a piece of that equation is the primary purpose behind them building the Large Hadron Collider over there in Switzerland, that they're trying to find this Higgs boson.
Yeah.
And this boson is supposed to generate a Higgs field. And massless particles passing through this Higgs field are supposed to acquire mass. Now, once they acquire mass, they can begin to generate a gravitational field. And then we begin to get an idea, from a materialist's point of view, how random particles, so to speak, can begin to coagulate and form stars and galaxies and those types of universal structures. This is why it's been nicknamed the God particle.
Uh-huh.
Because if they can determine that and assign a material explanation to these ordered effects through this Higgs field, then they're saying, well, this is doing the same thing that you say that your God does. And so this particle is basically the God that you've been worshiping.
Uh-huh.
It's almost sinister in a way behind it.
Yeah.
But there's problems with that. My theory predicts that they will never be able to prove that the Higgs field actually imparts mass. Because in its fundamental form, according to the mathematics of the Higgs field, the theory, the Higgs field yields a value to this field of infinity. Now, any time we come to a mathematical infinity in physics, we know we're barking up the wrong tree. We know we're making a mistake. Because nothing physical has a quality or a value of infinity.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they had to make up a companion particle that says that this would counterbalance the equation. And so make the Higgs field, finite instead of infinite.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, it's supposed to be a supersymmetrical particle. The problem is, further, is that this Hadron Collider was built with such a power that one of the first things they felt and predicted that they were going to find was supersymmetrical particles. And they never found them. They haven't found them yet. There's no trace for them whatsoever. So they're really kind of scrambling in a way a little bit because their experimental results are not proving out their philosophy that all physical observations actually have a physical cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always loved that movie. I think it was Creator when he was talking about how, you know, when they get the biggest, most powerful microscope and look down at it, they're going to see God waving back to them.
<You know? laughs> Well, that's kind of a comical way to look at it. That's for sure.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. I wouldn't expect to see a little old man with a beard, you know, and a laptop and a lightning bolt taking notes, you know. But it was kind of comical when I thought about it. It's that's the way I feel about it. I believe in a divine intelligence. That there's definitely whatever you want to call it, you know, that is, you know, putting order to things that actually set all this stuff into motion, you know. But at the same time, I also think that, you know, God was plural in the past, you know, the Elohim and all these other people, they were maybe little g gods that were doing a lot of tinkering around at the same time.
Well, it's difficult for me to speculate on that. You know, I've heard these kinds of propositions before.
Uh-huh.
And for me, what my focus is where do we get the order from that is reflected in the universe?
Uh-huh.
And so for me, my thinking is pretty much confined to that, something that I could link to a physically observable effect. The way I kind of look at it, for example, is this. I talk about going into a casino and sitting down at a blackjack table. And you have this huge deck of cards. And let's further, posit that no one is ever going to be allowed to see what's inside the deck of cards. It will be always invisible. No one will ever be able to observe it directly. But yet when the dealer starts dealing out the cards and the cards are turned face up, we have a materialization of the information that was stored in the invisible deck. And over a period of time, over enough years and decades and centuries, we can accumulate enough observations from what is materialized in order to get a very good idea of the structure that's in the deck, even though we'll never be able to directly observe that deck.
Mm-hmm. That does give you something to ponder. I always heard a really simple approach to things that one of the teachers I talked to, he was kind of an enlightened physicist, you might say. But, he was talking a lot about Bruce Lipton's work. And, one of the guys I work with had like 9 degrees or something like that. He was a biophysicist and things. And, it's interesting, the genome experiment, when they thought they were going to end up with like at least 70 to 100,000 genes that were operating the body, and then all of a sudden they found out there's only about half of the genes necessary to operate the body. And so they're at a quandary where they're saying, well, wait a second, there is some outside intelligence at play here to keep this vehicle going. Because there's, we just don't have a big enough computer here to make this happen. And I think that kind of pushed them over the edge, but they couldn't talk about what it was. They just said, they called it an unseen intelligence, but they couldn't say exactly what it was.
Well, certainly, one of the points that I try to make is that in the past, since our sciences have really come into being, hundreds of years ago, we have been fairly successful at finding physical causes for the physical effects that we observe.
Mm-hmm.
But in the recent couple of decades, we have grown in our power of observation with the technology that we have, both like with the Hadron Collider and the mm-hmm. telescopes that we actually orbit around the Earth so we can get them out of the atmospheric interference to see a clearer picture. We have only now come to a place in science where we have run out of material to explain all the effects that we see. When we go to look for that material cause, we can't find it anymore. We have more physical observations than we have physical material to explain it. And so I believe that science, we're in the process now of convincing ourselves that there isn't a physical explanation for every physical observation. And I think that once we run that gamut
mm-hmm.
and come to this realization that no matter what we try and how we search, we cannot find a graviton. We cannot find a particle of dark matter or dark energy. We cannot find supersymmetry. At that point, we will begin to consider what I talked about with the deck of cards, where we're mm-hmm. going to have to take all of our observations and from that, assemble a model that tells us what the cause really is, but accepting with that explanation that we will never be able to physically observe that cause.
Yeah, I agree. I, I, I go back to that one, you know, where they talk about 11 dimensions out there. But again, they want a physical proof of non-physical events or non-physical realities, you might say. And I've always been perplexed by that. You know, when you have, we had some things happen here where I had, you know, some triple PhD Boeing engineers here sitting out in this field, and this object appeared over the mountain. And it started bilocating from 1 to 3. It became 3 and then back to 1 again. It did it for about 20 or 30 minutes. And then 1 just got massive as it came to us. And then all of a sudden it stopped and it went away and it started getting smaller and smaller and just disappeared. So, you know, with them trying to wrap their head around that, they just basically couldn't do it. You know, all they could say was that, well, you know, we can't explain this one. This is something we know is not ours. We can't explain it, you know, and that's about as far as it went.
Well, one of the paradigms in my model, and in fact, if someone was to ask me, and somebody did on an interview, define mm-hmm. the universe, give three examples, right? What a huge question. And the answer that I gave them is that the universe is an expression of materialized information. Now, modern physics accepts the idea that information is at the heart of all physical structures, but they don't consider the materialized aspect of it because they just assume that everything is already materialized. It would be like saying wet water. We all know that water is wet. There's no need to mention that or even think about it. But to me, the universe is a collection of materialized and materializing information. Now, most of the structures in the universe are very stable, at least in the macro universe. Mm-hmm. But when we get into areas, James, like paranormal phenomena, ufology, hauntings, and quantum physics, we actually directly observe the process of information materializing and dematerializing in active real time. Mm-hmm. And so for me, paranormal evidence is one of the bulwarks of any theory of everything must consider, must embrace, because it happens, and it's been happening for a very long time, and it's been happening before we had any technology, which means whatever is causing these effects must be consistent with the laws and the principles in which the universe is assembled, because they're basically, in a sense, like what goes on in a haunted house is, in a sense, a natural effect. It's not an artificial effect. Mm-hmm. And UFOs, if they are, and again, I'm speaking what I can associate a one-to-one correspondence with observable reality. If UFOs mm-hmm. that do exist are intelligently controlled craft, I maintain that they have discovered the natural laws and principles that enable paranormal effects in a haunted house to take place, and have been able to exploit those laws technologically, because whatever these constructions are able to reproduce the very same types of effects that we see naturally occurring at the site of hauntings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that, definitely. There seems to be, you know, one of the ways I look at it, just for my own little cookbook, you might say, is that I go back to that, you know, everything goes from consciousness to light to energy to mass. And so beyond the physical, there's a dimension that might be comprised of beings that are, let's say, less dense physical or even energy beings. And their world would be physical to them, but it would match their frequency, you know, that they're on. And if you go up to the next level, there may be, you know, light beings that have magnetized light bodies, and their world would be more of a holographic light universe, and they probably have their light ships, you know, that they fly around in. And then, and some of the things we're seeing might just be pure consciousness, like they talk about Merkabahs, you know, and things of that nature. And to me, you know, that's just a simplistic way of looking at things, but I can't deny the effects of what we're seeing here. And actually, we're using technology to document this. We have third generation night vision that sees into the infrared realm. And then with that, we take an infrared spotlight and light up the field here. And boy, there is so much stuff walking around and flying around that you can't see with the regular eye, because they're just outside of the visible light spectrum that we can see. So we can use technology to light up these fields and actually make them visible. And I have some people here. I actually have a scientist here right now that's a writer that when we did this and showed him it, he said, boy, there's light spheres flying around this field. They're flying against the wind. They're some distance out. They're 9 inches to a foot. They're interacting with people. He said, this is the smartest dust I've ever seen, you know. Uh-huh. And so he could not, you know, he just said, you know, all I can say is that they seem to be intelligent. They seem to be defying, you know, what we know, you know, to that it's definitely not anything known, like a dust particle or rain or, you know, the skies were clear. So, you know, he said, basically, I'm just probably going to have to accept the obvious that, you know, these things are, you know, in just out of our visible light spectrum that we can see, and they are interacting with people and defying a lot of the laws as we know it, because they actually go right through physical objects. You know, they go into the ground and come back up again, you know, things like that. So it's really interesting.
An interesting point that you're bringing up, James, is like what I said earlier. You're talking about third generation night vision.
Yeah.
And again, this is an example of what I was talking about, that our technology is becoming so advanced and so increases our powers of observing the universe around us that we are beginning to pile up this collection of physical observations, of physical effects, for which we can find no physical cause locally mm-hmm. connected to it. And to me, this was one of the things I had to tackle very early on in my research, was to come up with a scientifically consistent and reasonable explanation for what constitutes quote-unquote paranormal. Mm-hmm. It just simply can't be this spooky catch-all basket that anything we think is weird or bizarre, we just dump it in this basket and call it paranormal. It had to be something more than that. And so, in giving it much thought, I came to the conclusion that, I came to the conclusion that the best definition that we could give paranormal is what physicists call non-local causality or non-locality, which means we have a physical observation, a physical effect, that is observable, that interacts with its physical surroundings, but has no direct physical cause locally connected to the effect. And so the example I normally give is in haunted sites where people hear disembodied voices. And the effect is an audible voice. That means what we're having is a compression wave in the air that is carrying a frequency and an amplitude through that medium to our eardrums or to a recording device. And the electronics of ether, so to speak, translates it into an audible sound. That's the effect. But what makes one voice normal, a normal voice, is that there's a set of vocal cords locally connected to the air column that's vibrating. That's normal. In a paranormal voice, there is no set of vocal cords. It just, all we have is the effect, very much like gravitational effect. We have an effect with no physical cause. And so once we pin that down as a definition for paranormal, it really allows us to take that understanding and bring it into other fields, like quantum physics, like gravitational studies, like ufology. And then we begin to have a foundation where we can make some coherent conclusions about what's actually taking place.
Yeah, I agree. There needs to be some kind of definition that we all agree upon. And once we do that, we can get together on this. I know one thing in the UFO field, it's kind of interesting. Nobody can agree on anything there. And I don't know what it's going to take to bring that group together. I just kind of, took myself out of it. I'm doing my own research and documentation and things like that. But, it is so interesting dealing with people who, so-called scientists, the main focus there is either keep it in the past or keep it off in the distance or keep it nuts and bolts. And not really looking at it in the moment that it's an ongoing thing and it's happening now and there might be extra dimensions to this phenomenon, or it's definitely a non-physical event, or whoever these beings are have actually mastered the physical and gone beyond it.
Well, certainly we have the same kind of a issue in the paranormal field, specifically the haunted house type field, where there's a lot of disagreement about different things, and lots of experts talk about, their own particular opinions. And then just as in ufology, we have the ones that are really way out there, they come up with ideas and explanations that are just so far out, that they can't be seriously considered. But what is going to create this foundation is we need two things, several things, first of all. Actually, we need a physical theory that sheds light on how these effects occur. Mm-hmm. And this is the work that I've done in Behind the Cosmic Veil. I've come up with a theory called supergeometrics. On the haunted end of the paranormal, there's a very well-recognized scientist named David Roundtree. And he's done some very, very interesting experiments into the paranormal, scientific experiments. Mm-hmm. And we met about 4 months ago, and we compared notes. And lo and behold, the kinds of experimental predictions that my theory makes, he had already gotten these results. He's verified portions of my theory. Mm-hmm. Now, people hear all kinds of things. They hear speculations. They hear philosophical viewpoints. They hear metaphysical viewpoints and theoretical viewpoints. What all of these have been lacking is the ability to make predictions about aspects of reality that are scientifically, experimentally testable. That last ingredient is what separates a scientific theory from everything else, from all the other background noise. And this is what I've come up with, a scientific theory of the supernatural that makes predictions that are experimentally testable. And probably about a half a dozen of those predictions have already been experimentally verified. Now that we have that, we can begin to build a foundation and say, well, this is this, but this over here is not. This is correct. This is an error. And we can weed out all this static and start getting a clear, definitive signal. Now, when it comes to UFOs, my approach is this idea that if they are technological, they are exploiting the science behind what happens in haunted houses. And so I like to talk about that science and the predicted effects and what has been experimentally verified, and then take that and project it out to ufology by showing how technology could be built upon these principles.
Mm-hmm. The insights on that from my own perspective, basically, it just makes sense if you find some way to increase the vibration or frequency of an object, even a physical object, and you get it vibrating fast enough, it's going to be, you know, it's going to pop into the next level, or what do you want to say, the next, everybody has different names for them. You could call it dimension or plane or, you know, different things, but depending on your vocabulary. And then if you could find a way to get it, you know, vibrating even faster, you know, it would shift, let's say it would shift into energy, and then it would shift into light, and then probably back to the original idea. But, you know, it really makes sense. And knowing what I know, I hate to say what I know, because I know people that were involved in the back engineering, you know, of some of these vehicles. And basically, there are different types of systems out there, different types of vehicles, but you know, it just makes sense that they would definitely know very easily how to create anti-gravity and counter-gravity as well, but at the same time know how to generate, you know, fields of energy like the Philadelphia experiment and become invisible or transport objects, you know, the ship and themselves, you know, using the action at a distance or you know, instantaneous travel. They've probably mastered all of these things, and it's just part of their everyday technology.
Well, my theory has a consistent model which shows how these things could take place. And mm-hmm. It involves very much the bending of space that not only causes the effect of gravity, but surrounds all physical objects, or what Einstein called physical content.
Mm-hmm.
See, according to Einstein's model, space is a field. It's not empty vacuum like Newton believed it was. Space mm-hmm. is a field that's defined by four independent variables: height, width, depth, and time. And so if you could, and what he further said is that all material content, all physical content, arose from areas of intensity and concentration within that field. While he was never able to prove that completely mathematically, many of his elements of general and special relativity, which were proved, grew naturally, arose naturally from that vision he had of universal reality. Mm-hmm. So in my model, what I describe is the means by which the bending of space can be accomplished from outside of space-time, superphysically, mm-hmm. or what I call super geometrically. And then furthermore, information which exists outside of space-time, and that's a very old idea.
Mm-hmm.
It goes from Plato's Forms through the Bible all the way up to, you know, David Bohm's Implicate Order, very prominent physicist of the 20th century, that mm-hmm. this bending of space is the crucible, is the womb, so to speak, in which information materializes. Hmm. So what you were talking about with vibrating something at a great frequency, I don't look at it that way. What I see is what would be required to collapse the bend of space that surrounds the physical object. Because if you collapse that bend in space, the object will dematerialize, and yet the information from which it was comprised remains intact.
Mm-hmm. So you would be, would that constitute almost instantaneous travel, because you would just be information now you wouldn't actually be a physical object anymore.
Exactly. And so consequently, whatever that collection of information, its coherence is, mm-hmm. would not be confined by the limitations of what is physical. You mm-hmm. know, you cannot overcome the confines of space and time unless you leave space and time. And so, for example, if we take a look at one of the, what they call the Holy Grail in paranormal investigation, which is a full-bodied mm-hmm. apparition, mm-hmm. and we've had verified instances where those apparitions were so detailed that people could recognize a person's face and their appearance, that was later identified in an old photograph of someone that might have lived in that house before. So what we have here, if we see the universe as an expression of materialized information, the original person that lived 100 years ago was comprised of information. When we see the apparition of that person materialized today, it's the exact same information. It's just materializing in our local space at this particular coordinate in time. But just because the original physical manifestation, the physical materialization of the body was dissipated and destroyed and turned into other forms of matter and energy, the information from which that matter was originally shaped remained intact. And so when that pattern is called down again, within the bend of space, that it can be materialized again from that same information.
Yeah, that definitely totally makes sense. I've got a couple of those Holy Grails. I've got some pictures that are just unbelievable. And, you know, one picture I have is a woman is sitting in front of actually the Santa Cruz Hotel in Santa Cruz, California, one of the really old buildings there that's been abandoned for quite some time, and she was sitting outside and all of a sudden got just deathly ill, got very sick, and she came to us for a counseling. We were doing some transpersonal release sessions, and I told her, I said, well, you've got an entity attachment to you, and you know, we've got to get rid of this guy because his energy is very sick, you know, very morbid energy. And I said, it feels very addictive, you know, very, it's just a sickening energy. And so we did some processes that I was trained in to remove this entity, and she got well almost instantly. But what was funny about it is her husband, who didn't believe in any of this, took a photograph of her. And in the photograph, you can see this being standing right over her, actually interfacing with her fields of energy. Mm-hmm. It's quite an amazing picture. I'll actually shoot that to you if you want. I'll shoot you and you can look at it. But it gets even more interesting because the husband went down to the police department and he said, hey, did somebody die in this building? And they said, yeah, not too long ago, a transient died of a drug overdose in this building. And he showed him the picture and they said, yep, that's him, you know.
Uh-huh.
So here you've got the photograph, you've got the police report, and the photograph of the guy's face, you can see his face pretty well, is exactly the same face of the transient that died. And then you have the effects that happened to the woman, you know, of actually picking up his energy and feeling that just incredible, you know, low self-esteem and grief and kind of a morbid reality that he was still holding on to.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's what we have to ask ourselves, okay? Think about this individual that passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And think about not just his shape, but also his metabolism. Everything that's happening biologically in the person, mm-hmm. perhaps even the information concerning the clothing that he might have worn, and particularly all of the activity within the brain itself, you know, emotional, thought, knowledge, mm-hmm. memory, all these types of things are all expressions of information. So clearly the very same information that materialized the person when he was living is the same information that's being materialized in this kind of an event. If we realize and stop and think, and I think that, didn't you one time interview Dr. Barry Taff?
I might have. I'm not, God, I've interviewed so many people. His name does sound familiar.
He's been in paranormal research for a long time. Uh-huh. And he says one of the things the paranormal investigators need to do, if he could tell them one thing, is get yourself a scientific education.
Yeah.
Because then it will help you understand what you're seeing. For a photograph to be taken in a camera, we must have reflected or emitted radiation in the visible spectrum entering into the lens. It has to be in the spectrum in which the film or the sensor is able to pick up, which means that what's happening is an actual physical effect. Otherwise, there would be no radiation reaching the lens of the camera from which the image could be recorded. You follow what I mean?
Exactly, yeah.
Therefore, if we're seeing within this radiation a recognizable structure and order and pattern that can be identified more so, moreover, by a photograph that was taken previously, then there is only one possible conclusion, that the very same information contained within the photograph of the original person is also materializing to create the image that the camera receives.
And one thing people need to realize is that the cameras do pick up more of the visible light spectrum than our eyes. So actually it would film something that we might not be able to see, but it would still pick up that that information or that energy signature, you know, whatever that may be.
Now, here's where we've run into trouble in the past, James. This is, I talk about conventional paradigms which cloud people's reasoning, which blocks their thinking. It's like a mental block, that as long as we embrace the paradigm, we can't see past it. I compare it to the ancients who, you know, adopted the Aristotelian model of the sky and the solar system. When they looked up, they saw the stars and the planets embedded in these giant crystalline spheres revolving around the Earth. It was Galileo who destroyed the crystalline spheres by discovering moons orbiting the planets, which would have obviously crashed through the crystalline spheres and destroyed them. But they couldn't see anything else because of the paradigm that they were operating under. Today, we don't have that mental block, and we look at the night sky, we understand what we're looking at for the first time. One of the paradigms that we run into problems is the term that I call spirit energy. And we use this word energy so often as you're using it. But from a scientific standpoint, we have to define what that energy is. And so consequently, when we go and think about that, we find that it's very difficult to identify what is meant by spirit energy. My argument is this, that whatever comprises spirit would be something that would distinguish an individual, like the spirit we're talking about now in your photograph. There's sufficient information in that quote-unquote spirit to uniquely identify that spirit as a particular individual and no one else. That kind of specific information, we have no place to store it in the physical local environment. It's not going to be stored inside of a wall or in the surrounding space, because that information by its very quality would mutate the wall into something that was half a person and half brick. stored locally. So one of the paradigms we get stuck in is the same paradigm that physics is stuck in, that everything has to be interpreted materialistically. Now, energy is material. It's physical. That's not something that exists outside of space-time. All energy is comprised as frequency and amplitude. Frequency is temporal. Amplitude is spatial. When you get above the speed of light where it's non-physical, all that collapses into a singularity, and you don't have energy anymore. So the term spirit energy, in my model, is an oxymoron. It is a conflict in terms. It's like saying honest politician. They are inconsistent. Now, here's where my model helps us, and it helps break the paradigm that blocks our vision, is that the energy is an effect. In other words, the spirit isn't composed of energy, but the process by which the information that the spirit is made of, the process by which that information materializes, generates an electrical energy field. And so when we're talking about spirit energy in my model, the energy is actually an effect. It is what's generated by the spirit materializing. You see what I mean?
And when we look at it that way,
we can begin to, you know, take the blinders off, so to speak, and see more clearly what may be going on.
Now, we can apply that same model to apparitions, you know, of Mary and some of the masters. We had an interesting phenomenon here. We had a monk here that he's from Japan, and this guy is highly evolved. He's having crazy things happen. He's been bilocating, and it's been well documented. And
a very busy person.
Yeah, he's a Yagong master and several other – he's mastered several other, you know, ancient forms. But just a beautiful guy. But he came out here, and he was sitting in the field, and we had two other investigative reporters with him. And he gets all excited, pulls his cell phone out, takes a picture. On his phone appears a picture of Kuan Yin, which looks identical almost to the photograph – I mean, an ancient painting of her. We looked her up on the internet, and we go, my God, she's holding the vessel. She's wearing a white gown. Her hair is the same. And there's this kind of an energy that looks like a dragon in the background that she's riding on. And it was you know, pretty incredible. And then he takes another picture of this other being that appeared to him, which was a big golden ball with wings. And then on top of that, he gets a photograph of Mary actually appearing here, and we have that on the website. And it's, when you look at this photograph, it really strikes you. And so I'm wondering, and you know, to me, I have two sides of me. One, I don't want to be a religious fanatic and say all these things are happening. You know, there's a part of me goes, oh, this is awesome. You know, I feel the energy. It feels incredible. It feels wonderful. But the other side of me is saying, well, what if there was just this really super advanced being on the other side of the veil with a with a little holographic toy, you know, that he's just having fun with?
Well, that's a very good observation, James. Here's what – and again, I have to keep going back to this because I want the audience to – really get a gist of what I mean by a new paradigm. And that new paradigm is that the universe comprises materialized information. So once we look at it that way, we can understand that all these images that you're speaking of are materializing information. That they're distinct, they're specific, they have structures and orders, recognizable forms in them. But when we understand it this way, and we accept David Bohm's implicate order, or Edgar Cayce's Akasha, which was the storehouse in both instances of this information outside of space-time that materializes into physical space-time, and we look at that collection of information that would contain the information on all of these images that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And think about it at the as information on the hard drive of a computer. I mean, you can't see it. It's not a perfect metaphor, but it conveys the right concept. You know, even if you tore the hard drive apart, you would only see these bare platters. You wouldn't see the ones and the zeros. And even if you were able to determine how to magnetically read those ones and zeros, without a mechanism to materialize those ones and zeros into a recognizable form, like a materialization of that information would be like a printed copy of a picture coming out of your printer. That would be the materialization of that information. The problem is this. Let's take this computer and further speculate that it has all this information on the Virgin Mary and these other images, these people you're talking about, on that hard drive, but it's in a library. And anybody can walk in and use that computer. And anybody who uses that computer would have full access to all the information that's on the hard drive. Mm-hmm. So if you get, you know, a disembodied voice in a haunted house that says, "This is Aunt Mary. I hid the keys under the trash can." And you go and look under the trash can and find the keys, and only Aunt Mary would have that information, and it sounds like the information of Aunt Mary's voice, doesn't necessarily mean Aunt Mary's running the computer.
Yeah, that is one way of looking at it. I also, too, it's kind of like with this, it's kind of interesting with this apparition. Let's say the apparition happens, and then you would have several people seeing the same thing, experiencing the same thing at the same time, and actually having physical results from it and intense emotional reactions to the energy, as well as actually healings that come from that. When you put all that together, there's definitely we have to say, okay, there's definitely some kind of a presence here, and this presence is interacting with people mentally and emotionally and physically. But that's about as far as we can go with it. We can't really say this is actually the being that, you know, this isn't actually the being that we think it is, but all the evidence might be pointing in that direction, but we can't say this is that being.
Right, but what we can say for certain is that what we're having, if it is observable, if it's physically observable in a recognizable form, we can say for certain that we have a materialization of information that results in that form. That's what we could say for certain. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as the photographs, I'm sure you remember the back in the 60s, Peter Hurkos, the man who was able to generate the photographic images on a Instamatic camera.
Yeah, just with his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He would take pictures of his face, and some of them were normal. Some of them were completely white or completely black. This is the Instamatic, the Polaroid instant developing in front of witnesses. And occasionally he would get images of remote places that were later identified to be a specific location somewhere in the world in front of witnesses with cameras and film that other people produced, you know, for him to use. So clearly he was doing something about materializing this information that he was picking up onto that camera. When we begin to look at everything as materializing information, it gives us a link. It gives us a handle on how to think about this stuff in a way to understand it. Now, as far as the energy, this is kind of an important thing. This is a real important aspect of my theory that I'd like to take a couple minutes and talk about if I could. Mm-hmm. one of the parts of this theory is the idea that space can be bent from outside of space-time. Mm-hmm. Its model concludes that the spatial bending that we see in the universe that doesn't have any adjacent mass causing the bend is not due to this invisible dark matter. It's due to an effect that's happening outside of space-time. 20th century mathematician and physicist Theodore Calusa, who actually balanced Einstein's unified field equations by adding a fifth coordinate outside of the four coordinates of space and time, which is pretty remarkable, he concluded that the bending of space was a superphysical or extra-physical effect. If we had this occur, let's say, like in the presence of physical matter, like a haunted house where we have atmosphere, that bending of space, if we had a bubble, let's say, that would expand, like somebody blowing up a balloon, but it's actually the fabric of space-time that's expanding in a bubble, the surrounding space would be crushed and compressed and bent. Any material, like air molecules occupying it, that mechanical compression would excite the electrons that are in the atoms, and they would jump them up into their higher orbits inside the atoms. And so the first thing that we would see is an electromagnetic field emerge out of thin air. And this goes along what I was saying earlier about there's no such thing as spirit energy. The process by which that information materializes into our local space generates the energy. The energy is an effect, if you follow what I mean. Now, what goes up must come down. And the electron comes down, it can emit photons, which is how an LED works. We pass an electromagnetic field through a material, excite its electrons. When its electrons drop back down into the lower orbits, they emit photons. That's how an LED works. So we could also have a luminous phenomena at the surface of this ball of space-time that's opening up. And if anybody's experienced in paranormal investigating, they'll realize that I've just given the world's first scientific description of what people call a luminous orb. It would be a ball of space-time jacketed by an electromagnetic field and emitting photons. They can also emit heat, so we could get a heat signature from it. And if we saw a thermal apparition, which we do see occasionally with these thermal imaging cameras, we would expect that apparition image to not be like a living person's image, where you have these wide variants of thermal signatures from the face to the tips of the ears to the hair to the clothing, that the thermal image would be more or less, its signature would be more or less uniform across the entire surface. And that's exactly what we see in these paranormal thermal images. We would also have, if the bubble opened up fast enough, we would have a vacuum inside temporarily before the laws of equilibrium allowed the surrounding air molecules and their associated heat thermal energy to fill it in. So this is what would give us cold spots in haunted houses. And it would also, the inrushing of that air would also give us these mystery breezes that people feel. So now I've just described five different observable paranormal effects at haunted sites with the same single mechanical model. This has never been done before. This is something completely new. We would also find, with this bending of space, we would find two other effects. This would predict and the appearance of a gravitational field on three axes. In other words, it wouldn't be a fluctuation of the lines of gravitational effect that are pointing down to the center of the Earth. This would open up in its own independent bubble, you know, in you know, omnidirectionally, you know, in all dimensions. It would open up at the same time because it's an independent field. And it's kind of funny when people in haunted sites talk about the onset of a paranormal event. They report a feeling of heaviness, which is exactly what this effect would cause. Now, when we bend space, we're also going to bend time. And so when we're stretching space, we're actually increasing the distance between two points by pushing the space out in between. And what we would record would be a time dilation. That when you bend space, you bend time as well. And so we have differences in temperature. We have differences in barometric pressure. We have an emergent electromagnetic field that is going to oscillate according to the information that's being materialized within this bubble. We are going to have a gravitational field that emerges on three axes, and we're going to record time dilation. And scientist David Rowntree had already experimentally verified all of these effects before we had ever met.
Yeah, it's nice to look at that pattern. I mean, the way that's explained, the I noticed when we do a lot of the counseling sessions, it gets. We just did one right before the show. We did a kind of a group clearing, and boy, the room, the temperature in the room just went up. We were like we're in a sauna, doing this clearing process, and so that would explain that effect. You know, where you would hit the get the heat. I was kind of attributing it to that our bodies are denser in frequency, and whenever you bring a higher frequency into a lower frequency, it would excite, you know, the molecules or the body and actually create heat.
Well, that could do so, although that would be recorded, you know, as an actual increase in people's temperatures. You know, of their bodies themselves. And, of course, you can only pump that up so much. I think, you know, before the body shuts down, it reaches, what, like 100? It can take a temperature of 105, 107, 108, somewhere in there, before it begins to shut down. Mm-hmm. But every, and again, this is basic science, every electromagnetic field generates heat. That's part of the effect of an electromagnetic field. And so certainly what you would be looking at is an effect that could be the result of an electromagnetic cause. Now, what's interesting about this model, let's say with an apparition, for example, we were talking earlier about the information about the person that's been dead for 100 years materializing within one of these bubbles of space-time. As soon as this information begins to materialize, the surface of that bubble is immediately going to conform to the external geometry of that being that's being materialized. And that's going to present a surface that not only has a recognizable order and structure, but it's also going to emit or reflect radiation like photons so that it can be seen. And yet there's no physical body in the middle of this bubble. It's like I say, you know, someday they're probably going to drag a body of a Bigfoot in the lab, but they're never going to be able to drag the body of a shadow ghost into a lab because there is no body. It's just that external shell that's in effect. But now let's say that information was in the form of a vocalization, which is also a collection of information, which is how we can play a song that's recorded in information on our hard drive through our computer and out of speaker, and it's actually a materialization of that audible information. If that happened, that bubble of space-time would immediately begin to take on the form of that materialized information. And so the surface of that bubble will begin to vibrate with the frequency and the amplitude of the materializing vocalization. We would have two effects, possible effects, given the frequency of the carrier wave that's being projected by this surface, conforming to this oscillation. We would have an audible oscillation. The surface of that bubble would actually create a compression wave in the air that would be carried to our ears, and we would hear it as a sound, as an audible voice. So according to my model, what in the case of disembodied voices, the local cause, the vocal cords, for example, are the actual surface of space, which is operating like the paper of a speaker. The surface of space itself is vibrating according to that materializing information, and that's what causes the voice to come out of thin air. Now, at another wavelength, it wouldn't create that audible compression wave. But remember, this bubble is jacketed by an electromagnetic field. So at a lower bandwidth, so to speak, it would still vibrate the surface of the bubble, but it would only affect the electromagnetic jacket around it. And now it would create an electromagnetic compression wave of the frequency and the amplitude of the materialized vocalization that in the right range, if you had a recorder in the right range, that field would enter the microphone. It would bypass the acoustic diaphragm and induce itself directly on the copper coils that are connected to the diaphragm. We wouldn't need to have an effect where the diaphragm is agitated acoustically. It moves the copper coils through a magnet, which creates the compression wave carrying the information that translates in the voice. The compression wave already exists. It induces itself directly on those coils. The device translates it into sound. And now we have an EVP that's heard on the microphone or heard on the recorder, and everybody standing around at present couldn't hear it because it wasn't an acoustical compression wave. Mm-hmm. This has already been experimentally verified. I make a prediction that we should be able to pick up an EVP in a vacuum and pick up an EVP with a microphone where the diaphragm has been surgically removed with an X-Acto knife. And both of these experiments were previously verified by this researcher, David Roundtree.
Well, that's interesting. You could actually create a device, and I've heard people do it. They call them spirit boxes or whatever. Just get rid of the diaphragm and get a big enough coil. You could probably be talking to the other side pretty easily.
Well, we don't know exactly how to set up a convincing, a two-way communication. That we don't know yet. That's something that is predictable. David has done a lot of work in his field and has realized that a lot of what is called ITC, where they try to do this two-way communication technologically, is fraudulent. It's outright faked. And he could tell you about the people he's talked to and what he's researched and all that. So we really don't have anything like that yet. However, according to my model, according to my theory in the book, it would be theoretically possible to design such a device.
Well, I'd like to have one. I have quite a few questions I'd like to get across to the other side. But
there's that other part of it. You don't know who's talking to you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you always have to use discernment. But I think we have that. We have that built into, our own physical bodies or whatever. We have not just the five senses, but we have sacred senses of, clairvoyancy and clairaudience and things of that nature, which have been, pretty much demonstrated and talked about throughout the ages. But then again, once you have those gifts, you've got to learn how to deal with them and how to let's say, heal unseen negative influences or learn how to change the channel and tune out some of the ones that aren't beneficial.
Now that I've talked about these different effects, this is where it relates to ufology. So when we see this bubble of space-time emerge, and one of the things David Rowntree has been able to do for us is he creates a controlled environment within the site of a haunted house by using what he calls a wormhole detector. He actually lays out an electromagnetic grid in the shape of a square with a sensor at each corner. So he's able to identify the specific location of the emergent point of all of these phenomena. And then he's been able to basically, what he says, throw the kitchen sink at it, point all of his detectors at that specific emergent point, and finds all of these effects that I was talking about, the temperature change and the barometric change and the dilation of time and the generation of gravitational fields by this emergent bubble or funnel in the local space. Now, the converse or the reverse is true. When you collapse that bubble, you dematerialize the information that's inside of it. And like I said, in the haunted house, we see these expansions and collapsing of these bubbles in real time. Now, if we were able to, and follow me for a moment, this is what I'm going to talk about, UFO technology, in a way that you've probably never heard before. Let's say we have an object, you know, a person or a spaceship or whatever, and it's surrounded by a bubble of space-time, as Einstein proved to us. Everything has bent space around it. What if we were to find a way to collapse that bubble? As that bubble began to collapse, like it does in real time at the site of a haunting, the image or the information inside of that bubble would begin to dematerialize. It would reduce what I call its physical presence in dimensional space. As it receded, a couple of things would happen. First of all, the effect of local gravity on it would be diminished because its mass would be dematerializing. It might actually lift and float around like a UFO. Like an apparition. It would eventually still have a recognizable outline, but it would begin to become translucent. It would become transparent so you could see through it. And in fact, there might be so little materialization that it could pass through a solid wall and still maintain some sort of an order with it. So here we're talking about materialization, dematerialization, the root technology behind which we could affect teleportation, perhaps even time travel, because the person who died 100 years ago, whose image we saw materialize in front of us today, his information has actually traveled through time from the past to the future. We could have bilocation. And we could basically have interstellar travel. All of the quote-unquote supernatural effects, if we had the technology based on this principle that I'm describing for the first time in the history of science, we could reproduce all these effects. And that, to me, would explain what UFOs do and how they do it.
You know, that definitely would. I have a photograph of a UFO that actually looks like it's creating its own little wormhole and where it just pops out of. And, I caught it right at the time where the field is there and all of a sudden it just pops out. It appears out of this field. And it's quite interesting. And that it's not a lot of these ships, they don't fly like regular ships. They just like pop in and out, and they seem to have the ability to type in or whatever, punch in a location and a time, and they're just there.
Just like an apparition in a haunted house.
Exactly.
It's not like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can fly. I mean, once they have popped in and they're in this dimension or whatever, they can fly around and just like a regular ship or plane or whatever. But they're not limited to that type of flight because we've had some really interesting things happen here. We had one beautiful light ship hovering over the ranch, and it looked like an F-15 or something. It was vectoring in on it, with the afterburners going, and this object just disappeared, just gone, and the jet goes by and it reappears, right behind it. And so they did a cat and mouse game for, probably about 10 minutes. We watched it. It was hilarious watching this go on. Because a jet would have to do a big long pass and turn to come back, and it would vector in on it and be coming in on it, and the thing would pop again and be gone. Uh-huh. And so this was going on for quite a while. It was really interesting observing this, and then the weirdest part about this thing is on the last pass. The jet went by, it disappeared, it reappeared behind the jet, and it was flying right down the jet's tailpipe. And as it got to the jet, it dematerialized into this just flared out energy or light and just disappeared. It went over the jet. And I would give anything to talk to that pilot to find out, what his experience was and how do you deal with what his feelings were after dealing with something that was that advanced, and why you would even try to chase one of these things or fire upon them is gives military intelligence a whole new meaning.
Well, when we're talking about UFO flight, here again we have a very strong parallel between ufology and paranormal phenomenon, a haunted house. Mm-hmm. We see levitations, poltergeist activity, where objects just fly across the room with visible means of propulsion and mm-hmm. no measurable energetic field that would be required to propel an object like that. There's been valid reports of things like televisions, like the old-fashioned ones, and even refrigerators, moving like they weigh nothing, but with no visible means of propulsion. But now, let's look at it a second. What if we had the technology, if we had discovered the secret to purposefully bend the fabric of space-time? Einstein was very fond of comparing in his mental, models, what he called thought experiments. He was very fond of likening the fabric of space to a sheet of rubber. And so imagine if we had a stretched out sheet of rubber, and we were to place a baseball on it, for example. Now that baseball would sink into that rubber, and it would cause a pocket of space-time, which is Einstein mm-hmm. said, this is a kind of a good conceptual way to look at how space bends around mass. Now, if we wanted to roll that baseball across that rubber sheet, because it's sunk into a pocket like that, it's going to take a certain amount of force and resistance. So we're going to reach out our hand, we're going to roll the ball across the rubber mat, and there's going to be some resistance to it. And the means of propulsion, of course, is going to be our arm and hand. Now, what if we were to do an end around on this, James? What if we were going to reach underneath this fabric from the outside of space-time, so to speak, and pinch the rubber in front of the ball and pull it down? to create an artificial pocket of space-time. Well, the ball would roll down into the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. What if we were able to move it forward, advance that pocket along with the ball? Well, the ball would start to roll down into that depression. Then the depression would be moved forward, and the ball would be pressed up on the inside rim of that pocket. And as that pocket accelerated, the ball would be carried along with it, and it would ride this bubble of space-time like a surfer rides a wave.
Mm-hmm.
And you would create incredible velocities with no visible means of propulsion. Furthermore, if you did a 90-degree turn at 3,000 miles an hour, the occupants inside the baseball wouldn't be pushed against the sides of the ship because they would be in their own relative space-time. They'd mm-hmm. be in their own relative bubble of space-time. So they wouldn't be subject to the inertia that's going on outside of it in a different space-time reference.
Mm-hmm.
And so this would explain poltergeist activity and UFO propulsion.
It makes sense. I always tell people they talk about making a right angle turn or whatever in these ships, that there's no way that they could do that because they'd all be splattered up against the door or whatever else, or the side of the ship. And I just said, well, you know, right now, what are we traveling? I think we're spinning at something like 1,000 miles an hour and going through space at I forgot the speed we're going through space. And I said, you don't even know what's happening. You know, so it's
whatever they're doing is clearly bypassing the normal need of physical propulsion and also the effect of air mm-hmm. and aerodynamics against it. These things are able to move in ways that are completely independent of conventional aerodynamic considerations. But with this ball of space-time, what you're actually doing is the physical substance which contains the air, the physical space which contains the air, is actually remains outside of that bubble that the craft is occupying and flows around it. The air resistance and the aerodynamic factors never enter inside of the space-time bubble that the ship is occupying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. The I have another video actually of a ship that followed is taken through in an airliner that was going from Portland to L.A. basically, and I had this one scientist look at it, and he says, "Oh yeah, that was just a weather balloon caught in the jet stream that followed the plane." And, you know, all these descriptions of it and everything he was coming up with. And I said, well, you know, I thought the jet streams were going like east and west there. And this is going north and south. And I said, this thing is traveling, matching the speed of the plane for quite a long time. I don't see how that could be. But in this object, when you see it flying, it's kind of an orange a white and orange, basically, a little orange light coming off the bottom, but in front of it is a black, like a void that it's creating. It's actually creating a void in front of the ship as it's flying along. And I found that interesting, and I found out through other sources that that's how some of their vehicles fly, is they actually create a void, and they're always falling into that void, you might say.
Well, that sounds exactly what I was describing.
Yeah.
Except that, instead of this, this is what's so revolutionary about this work. Instead of having to depend on some of these ambiguous concepts, well, it's kind of like this or that, mm-hmm. it's actually describing a scientifically consistent physical model by which these things can be expressed. And like I said, we have already some very significant experimental verification. I really do believe that the haunted house type paranormal phenomenon is where we need to focus most of our efforts in science, because they occur very close to our proximity personally. Mm-hmm. They occur at a scale that we as human beings can reckon with much more easily, rather than UFOs that occur at a much larger and more distant scale. And they occur consistently enough in specific locations that we can actually set up experimental equipment and create controlled environments and do the science that's necessary much easier in paranormal hauntings than we can with ufology.
No, definitely, I agree. That's somewhere we need to go. We're coming up to the end of the hour, so I definitely can't thank you enough. I mean, you've actually opened my eyes to a different way of explaining things and looking at things, and it really makes sense, you know, as far as things manifesting, you know, as a as information, you know, and that process. What is the best way that people can read your books or get in contact with you if they want to?
Well, the information about my book, sample chapters, descriptions of it, related articles, links to where to find the book and purchase it, and even a contact email if you want to get a hold of me. Mm-hmm. I do answer all my emails. All can be found at www.cosmicveil.com. And if you're interested in David Roundtree's work, you would go to his site, which would be, think about the word investigations, but begin it with the word spin. Spinvestigations.org, and you could see my collaborative associates work in the scientific equipment and the experiments with the paranormal that he's been doing.
Great. We'll have to do that. You know, well, again, I can't thank you enough, Thomas, for coming on the show, and it was very enlightening and gave us a lot of the scientific answers that we're looking for and a new verbiage to use, you know, in explaining these phenomenons. And keep up the great work, and we'll have to get you on again real soon and just go deeper into this phenomena.
Well, thank you very much, James. And yes, we can, I'd be happy to come back. Just shoot me a date. And you could just tell by just what we've talked about in this 2 hours that this model can take us very, very deep into the rabbit hole. So I'd be happy to come back and, carry the conversation on further with you.
Great. Oh, well, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. And unfortunately, we're out of time. So this is James Gilliland signing off with As You Wish Talk Radio. Have a great day. Good night.